Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. There's a West African city that represents the end of the world, the remote place that inspired the phrase, from here to Timbuktu. But today, Timbuktu, along with the rest of northern Mali, is drawing the world's rapt attention. The area is no longer a vague destination, but the target of an impending Western-backed military intervention. The region, which is as big as Texas, has been taken over by Tuareg rebels and Islamic militants, linked to the Al-Qaeda terrorist movement. They've imposed a violent form of Sharia with public whippings, beatings, amputations, and stonings. The militants in the normally tolerant nation are forcing women to cover up, and they're preparing for war against the coalition of African forces who are backed by European nations that consider the Islamic militants a significant threat to political stability in West Africa. Mali's militants have now been linked to the attack on the American consulate in Benghazi, Libya. Our guest on Global Journalist today is a writer from Mali who will give us an insider's perspective on the escalating international crisis in the newest failed state. Mohamed Keita works for the Committee to Protect Journalists in New York. He's the agency coordinator for CPJ's Africa program. Welcome to the show, Mohamed.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into the latest developments, Mohamed, would you please give us a quick description of northern Mali? What it looks like and where it's located?
Yeah, northern Mali is the size of France. It's the heart of the Sahara Desert. It essentially goes from Sahara to Savanna. These are vast expanses of open desert, sparsely populated with very small towns and rural communities. It is crossed by the Niger River, which goes up north and then downwards through the cities of Timbuktu, Gao, which are some of the biggest population centers. Timbuktu, as Americans know it, is this town on the edge of the desert that's been, you know, the subject of so much mythical interpretation in the U.S. conscience, but it's this ancient city that was a booming trading town up to the 16th century because it hosted an Islamic university and it's a World Heritage Site. And a lot of trade from the Mediterranean and North Africa used to flow through Timbuktu. There is a large collection of medieval manuscripts in Spanish and Arabic covering all subjects from math, science, philosophy, business, theology. So all these books and all these scholars from North Africa, from the Middle East, from the Mediterranean, used to travel to Timbuktu on camel caravans crossing the Sahara to get to Timbuktu because it was a place where the Mediterranean and North African world met the sub-Saharan African world. So there was this exchange, this trade. Goods from the south, from the heart of Africa, were exchanged with goods coming from the northern part of Africa and the Middle East.
And geographically, it's just south of Algeria and two countries over from Libya.
Yes, indeed. Mali is landlocked. It's sandwiched between about 7 or 8 countries in the center of West Africa. And it's a country that has a lot of ethnic diversity, like like all over Africa, but it carries the name of a medieval empire, the Mali Empire, which was occupied a larger area in West Africa. Right. And so it goes back to the 13th century, and people are certainly familiar with Mali Empire in literature. There's just the epic of Sundiata Keita, the founding emperor of Mali. And there are also, it's very rich in terms of culture, and today most known for music, obviously, the music from Mali. A lot of Americans know musicians from Mali who are world-renowned for the music.
Right. When I told my son that we were doing a show on Mali, he played me his favorite guitarist, Sidi Touré.
Yes, indeed. He's one of many artists that are known outside Mali.
And they have an annual music festival that draws people from around the world. And I understand they had to move it out of northern Mali this year because of the rebellion?
Yes, indeed. They called it Le Festival du Désert. So this was the world's only music festival held in the desert. And it started around, 2001 or 2002. And it was attracting international artists from all over the world who trekked to Timbuktu, and you camped out on the edge of the desert, and they set up a stage, and various artists came and played, and it coincided with an annual traditional festival for the nomadic Tuareg people who are the masters of the Sahara, this Berber tribe. And during that time, in January of each year, they come to Timbuktu because there is a well. It's an oasis, mm-hmm, sort of town. And they bring their camels, and they have all these cultural festivals, you know, camel races, traditional music festivals. So, yeah, the festival was arranged around that time. So it was a mix of very local and traditional culture, and bringing in international artists as well.
And let's bring back the Tuaregs. Now, my understanding is that even though Mali had a democracy beginning in 1992, the Tuaregs were always a bit rebellious in the north. And in the past 6 months or so, that the dynamic has changed because of the militants coming from Libya. Can you kind of explain how, in the past year, the dynamics have changed in northern Mali and why?
Yeah, well, first of all, as you know, Mali, just like all African countries are, except maybe for Ethiopia, most African countries are the results of colonial dissection, but it is artificial borders that were arbitrarily drawn all over the map of Africa. Mm-hmm. And Mali is the Tuaregs are one of these people, just like the Kurds. They are sort of like caught in between these arbitrary borders because their domain is the Sahara, so it goes across a band, the Sahel, the band of the Sahel, east to west. So it's a huge region that covers today many countries across that, you know, West Africa. So they're found in Mali, they're found in Niger, they're found in Mauritania, they're found in Algeria, they're found in Libya. So they are sort of caught in between all these countries and all these borders. And their rebellion goes back to the colonial time, because when the French came to conquer Mali, they initially, when they seized control of Mali, the Tuareg rebelled and they were brutally massacred by the French. So it goes back to colonial times. And then when Mali gained its independence, Tuaregs had grievances and wanted to be independent as well. So there were several rebellions that the Malian government also crushed. So they have been rebelling for decades. These are nomadic people that have very independent spirits because they have lived in the Sahara for centuries, and they're masters of trade. They're very independent. You know, they don't like to be controlled. So this issue has come up in the 90s, and many of them fought, and eventually they signed a peace deal with the government. At the base of some of the grievances are legitimate concerns about the lack of development in the north of Mali, neglect from the government in the south. It's not an issue that's linked with discrimination of any kind, because many Tuaregs are, in the government. Mali doesn't really have any ethnic tensions. So this has solely to do with land and development issues. So these Tuaregs, after the Libyan conflict, because many of the Tuaregs had been in Libya, late Colonel Muammar Gaddafi actually befriended the Tuaregs and provided them with weapons and military bases, training, as they were rebelling. Throughout all these successive rebellions, they found in Libya a safe haven. And when Colonel Gaddafi was deposed last year, many of these Tuaregs who had been fighting with Colonel Gaddafi in Libya returned to Mali, and they returned with a lot of heavy weapons. And initially, they were welcomed by the president of Mali with open arms, because Colonel Gaddafi enjoys a lot of support in Mali. He has invested a lot in Mali, and he has spent a lot of money in Mali. So there was quite, Malians are quite supportive of Colonel Gaddafi. So it appears that these Tuaregs did felt emboldened with the weapons they had, felt emboldened to push for independence and via weapons, via arms, and they decided to, take on the Malian army, which they routed, and then they allied themselves with these jihadist radicals and elements linked to Al-Qaeda. But it appears that there, at some point in the last few months, in June or July, as their agreement fell through, and the jihadists instead took over and kicked out the Tuaregs. So the jihadists control now much of northern Mali, and the Tuaregs have now come to the conclusion that they no longer want to fight for independence. They want to talk now. They want negotiations. They no longer want to fight.
And this also is linked to, this issue is also linked to the coup. The democratically elected president was ousted by some renegade soldiers. And my understanding is that a lot of people blame the president for allowing these armed Tuaregs and others into the country.
Yes. The president was blamed, and there was a lot of public criticism about his handling of the Tuareg rebellion once it broke out. I mean, the army was routed, and it was quite embarrassing. The army was complaining that it didn't have enough weapons to fight, and the president received a lot of criticism, even from the wives, the widows of soldiers who had been killed in a rebel attack. And so it created this crisis between the lower ranks of the army and the senior officers, and that's what led to the coup, essentially. But the coup itself happened within a month of presidential elections. The incumbent president was in his second and last term and had a month left in office. So he was on his way out. Despite this, they staged the junior army officers staged this coup, and the population's expectation at the time, hope, was that they would turn around the situation militarily. But that didn't happen. In fact, it was worse. It created a chaotic situation that allowed the Tuareg rebels and the jihadists to actually gain more territory. So the country is now cut in half, with the northern half controlled by the jihadist elements.
Now, let's move on to some of the latest news. The European Union has already pledged to support the proposed West African force with training, transport, and intelligence gathering. And now that Wall Street Journal is quoting sources who say the EU may pay for equipment and monthly allowances to the roughly 3,000 troops from West African countries. Do you think an international military invasion to recapture the North is now certain, at least, and just a matter of timing, from your understanding of the news?
Yeah, I would. That's my personal understanding of the news of what's going on right now.
And one of the three groups controlling northern Mali has just offered some concessions. Do you think that's significant?
We'll see. I'm not privy to the negotiations.
Right.
I have no idea. One thing I want to point out, though, is that the U.S. military, since September 11, has been quite heavily involved in this region, in Mali and in the neighboring countries. They were concerned about this type of scenario, about, you know, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, which actually exists and has been, doing kidnappings of Westerners and, terrorist attacks in the region. And in the case of Mali, the U.S. military went in Mali and for years had been training the Malian military to prevent this type of scenario. So one question, big question about this story that has not been fully investigated is, what was the net value or result of the U.S. military's training or involvement in the past decade with the militaries of the countries in the region, particularly Mali, to prevent this type of situation? Was it? It seems like it was a failure.
Yeah.
Or that the truth. That's a question that the media hasn't asked.
Right. I want to get back into the discussion of the media, but before we continue our discussion, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to our program on our website. So please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org or our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at globaljourn. That's global, JOURN. Mohammed, how is the local or the Malian media portraying these developments? And then we can talk about how the overall problem with the media in Africa.
Yeah, well, I honestly, I'm not the best person to answer that question. I think someone on the ground would be able to give you a better feel. I haven't personally been monitoring the coverage, so I couldn't answer that question. I've spoken to journalists in the north of Mali, and, many of them do not want a military intervention because, the loss of life and the destruction that it brings.
Right.
Now, many of them would rather see a peaceful negotiation, and a peaceful outcome to this. But I mean, that some of the reality is that some of these extremist groups, you know, do not always believe in dialogue.
Right. And you were born in Mali and lived there until you were 11 and have a lot of family there. And I understand you were back there about a year ago. When you're in contact with journalists and family, what are they telling you about what it's like there now?
Well, people are just, you know, suffering economically, obviously. That's the biggest issue. A lot of youth unemployment, just day-to-day survival issues that preoccupy people. So the issue of the North is somewhat remote. I mean, there is obviously a lot of anger and frustration at the fact that, you know, the northern part is controlled by these jihadist thugs who are, you know, committing these barbaric atrocities and bringing it, imposing on innocent people a brand of Islam that is alien to the culture of Mali. I mean, mm-hmm. Even the ban on music is seen as, you know, untenable. I mean, for a country that, you know, whose life is in music and unity is in music, and that being taken away. So it's a difficult situation for everybody.
And there's also a severe food shortage. Is that make things worse now? Is it getting worse?
I'm fully familiar with that, so I'm not the best person to ask.
Okay. From what I've been reading, there's a pretty significant food shortage, and that's compounding the problems there, along with the instability in the government, and with people not even saying they're not even thinking about elections now. We're just trying to survive and avoid a war. I read that the militants have been going to places like Timbuktu and destroying some of the cultural artifacts. And it sort of reminded me of what happened in Afghanistan with the destruction of the Buddhist monuments.
Yeah, absolutely. These terrorist extremist elements want to create in Mali a jihadist paradise similar to the Taliban in Afghanistan. Some of them are foreign fighters, foreign jihadists, and they have been recruiting a lot of unemployed youth from the area who have nothing to do, and they give them a weapon and a cause and a calling, and they follow them. It's unfortunate, but they have been destroying the Sufi shrines in Timbuktu. You know, as I said earlier, Timbuktu was a center of knowledge in the 13th century because it hosted this Islamic university that at one point boasted 13,000 students and scholars from all over the Islamic world that came and taught subjects from math, physics, you know, science, geography, literature, you know, theology. So it was a very cosmopolitan town when, you know, Timbuktu was a golden age city. Mm-hmm. And now these, obviously, there's a treasure chest of artifacts, these medieval manuscripts in Spanish and Arabic that are in Timbuktu. And the reason why it's a World Heritage Site is that. Right. And these jihadists are intolerant of any other brand of Islam other than their own extreme and strict interpretation of Islam.
Right.
So they have been attacking the Sunni shrines.
In our final couple minutes, let's talk briefly about the attacks on journalists in Mali. I understand that it's become pretty dangerous to be a journalists there now?
Yeah, following the March 22nd coup, there was a breakdown in the rule of law in the south, in Bamako, for instance, and we documented 9 detentions or kidnappings of journalists, either by state security or unidentified assailants who kidnapped journalists and interrogated them over their coverage of the military and the government. And then in the north, we saw a record number of attacks. You know, most of the... let me pull back a second.
Yeah.
So Mali has, over the last 2 decades, been one of the safe havens of press freedom in Africa. It has one of the most vibrant press in Africa, one of the freest and most vibrant, most outspoken, and a number of radio stations, I mean, more than 200 radio stations, and going back to all the local communities and newspapers, very open media, and one of the best places to be a journalist in Africa. So from 2008 to 2011, there was not a single attack on a journalist, not a single act of censorship. After the March 22nd coup, however, we documented a record number of attacks on journalists, at least 59 separate incidents.
Wow.
Most of these were perpetrated by jihadist militants occupying the north of the country.
Okay, I think we're going to have to wrap it up there. We've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist. Joining us today was Mohamed Keita. Our program is produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Our program is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungakar is our executive producer. Our lead producer today is Sravani Pair. Now stay with us for Free Press Watch and join us again next week for another Global Journalist.
And now Free Press Watch, a segment on Global Journalists where each week we bring you a rundown of major events affecting press freedom around the world. I'm Taylor DeHaze. Today's news comes from the Committee to Protect Journalists, Reporters Without Borders, and the International Press Institute. Journalists in Chad have expressed feeling intimidated and threatened by Dobas Mayor Limlinger Nagaspi, editor-in-chief of Le Voix du Paysan, and other 2 journalists reported feeling threatened after a series of broadcasts aired in late September accusing the mayor of abuse of power and hiring practices favoring attractive women. CPJ reports that the mayor threatened to burn down the station. The Union of Private Radio Stations in Chad reported the mayor assaulting a Le Voix du Paysan reporter in late September. The journalist suffered injuries to his back, neck, and legs. The mayor denied all allegations. Senegalese President Macky Sall committed to decriminalizing press offenses within the country. IPI Executive Director Alison Bethel McKenzie welcomes Sall's commitment and says she hopes this will end the act of using criminal courts to accuse journalists for libel. A Philippine radio journalist was shot by an unidentified man on a motorcycle during his morning commute on November 8th. The body of Julius Cazo was found on the road about 2 kilometers from the station where he was a host. His show often discussed local politics and criticized the government. For more information on these and other events affecting press freedom around the world, please visit our website at globaljournalist.org. Thank you for joining us this week on Global Journalist. I'm Taylor DeHaze.